This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. Boris Johnson resigned Thursday as leader of Britain's Conservative Party, triggering a race to succeed him as Prime Minister. After a frenzied 48 hours which saw dozens desert his scandal-hit government, the AP's Karen Chamas reports.
The Prime Minister has been accused of lying about government office parties that broke pandemic lockdowns, also being too close to donors, and most recently promoting an MP who he knew was accused of sexual misconduct. Opposition Labour Party MP Naz Shah noted, however, that Johnson's Conservative Party politicians were as dishonest as their leader.
Each and every one of them kept him here, and now trying to take the moral high ground that he's finally on his way out.
Scottish MP Daniel Johnson said that the Prime Minister leaves a shameful legacy in his wake.
He's left behind a trail of political chaos, of economic destruction.
Meanwhile, many were concerned as to how the government will function while so many politicians had resigned in protest. Conservative MP Michael Ellis assured the public that business will go on as usual.
Government and the civil service will continue to function in the meantime, as they always have done.
Karen Chamas, London.
Johnson said he plans to stay on as Prime Minister until the party elects a new leader to replace him. Conservative John Major, who was a Prime Minister from 1990 to 1997, said that was unwise and may be unsustainable. Jailed American basketball star Brittany Griner pleaded guilty Thursday to drug possession and smuggling during her trial in Moscow, but said she had no intention of committing a crime, Russian news agencies reported. The reports quoted the WNBA star as saying through an interpreter at the court hearing that she had acted unintentionally because she was packing in haste. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that U.S. Embassy officials attended Griner's trial and delivered a letter to her from U.S. President Joe Biden. This is VOA News. President Vladimir Putin, speaking to senior lawmakers, said Thursday Moscow's intervention in Ukraine marked a shift to a multipolar world. He accused the collective West of unleashing a war in Ukraine, saying he's heard they want to defeat Russia on the battlefield. His response, quote, let them try, end quote. U.S.-based analysts say Russia may be taking an operational pause after claiming victory in Luhansk. AP correspondent Jennifer King reports.
Analysts with the Institute for the Study of War say Russia may be temporarily easing its offensive, reassembling forces for a renewed assault in Ukraine. The think tank says that for the first time in 133 days, Russian forces claimed that did not mean the complete cessation of active hostilities. Ukrainian officials say shelling continued in the east, with several civilians killed and wounded in the last 24 hours, mostly in the Donetsk province, where fighting is ongoing. 10 cities and villages came under shelling, and 35 buildings were destroyed, including a school and a hospital. In Kharkiv, the second largest city, a boarding school was hit, but no one was injured. The Ukrainian military said Russian forces also carried out helicopter strikes in the Sumy region in the northeast. I'm Jennifer King.
A UN study released Thursday shows the first 3 months of the war in Ukraine have driven up the global cost of fuel, food, and other commodities, creating a surge of inflation that has helped drive 71 million people into poverty. VOA's Jeff Custer reports.
Officials with the UN Development Program said the study analyzed 159 developing countries and shows the war-driven price spikes in key commodities had immediate and devastating impacts on the world's poorest households. Speaking virtually at a Geneva news conference, UNDP senior economist George Gray Molina said the economic shock of Russia's invasion of Ukraine came after 18 months of COVID-19 pandemic lockdowns.
With COVID, what we saw is effects that was slow and cumulative, but had a very strong impact over time. So the official estimates are about 125 million people falling into poverty over about 18 months. So what we find right now is that 3 months of inflation have drawn about 71 million people into poverty.
The study offers several recommendations to address the issue, suggesting, for example, multilateral investment banks such as the International Monetary Fund could provide more capital to allow nations to specifically address their needs. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
Hong Kong has announced that it is shelving a COVID flight ban measure that has left dozens of flights canceled in recent months. Government officials announced the city will no longer ban arriving flights because they had brought in passengers that tested positive for COVID-19. Previously, a 5-day flight ban was imposed on airlines if at least 5 passengers tested positive. That has caused about 100 flight cancellations since the beginning of the year. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
We'll be right back. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I am very optimistic that a new leader will emerge next year, and that will change the tide of insecurity we're having now.
That was Isiaka Mustafa, publisher of Abuja-based People's Security Monitor, expressing hopes that Nigeria's next president will be able to ease the rush of brazen attacks across the country. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Scandal-ridden Boris Johnson announced today that he is stepping down as British Prime Minister after he was abandoned by ministers and most of his Conservative lawmakers, bowing to the inevitable as more than 50 ministers quit and lawmakers said he must go. An isolated and powerless Johnson spoke outside 10 Downing Street to confirm he would resign. He said, quote, "The process of choosing the new leader should begin now, and today I have appointed a cabinet to serve as I will until a new leader is in place," end of quote. The Conservatives will now have to elect a new leader, a process which could take weeks or months. Johnson last visited Africa to attend the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Kigali, Rwanda. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has vowed to defeat the Oromo Liberation Army, OLA, an insurgent group he is blaming for two massacres in the past 3 weeks. Fred Harter has more from Addis Ababa.
Addressing Parliament Thursday, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed condemned two recent massacres targeting members of the Amhara ethnic group as inhumane acts of violence carried out by evil forces. The most recent massacre took place on Monday in the West Welliger zone of Ethiopia's Oromia region, resulting in an unknown number of deaths. Those killings followed a separate incident last month in which armed men killed 338 Amhara villagers, according to official government figures. Ethiopia's government blames the Oromo Liberation Army, or OLA, for the killings. The insurgent group claims to be fighting for greater autonomy for the Oromo people, Ethiopia's largest ethnic group, but it has been accused of a spate of bloody human rights abuses. Speaking to lawmakers on Thursday, Abiy pledged to eliminate the OLA. He also made a rare admission of losses on the government side, saying that police officers and soldiers have been dying on a daily basis battling the insurgent group. He added that warrida, or district officials, have also been assassinated. Hear his words spoken by an interpreter from Ethiopia's state broadcaster.
In Wolega, hundreds of reports have been given to you. Hundreds of warrida leaders have been killed. It's not as easy as speaking in this forum. People dying in discharge of their duties.
Abiy's address came a day after Ethiopia's parliament held a moment of silence for the victims of the massacres and set up a committee to investigate. Phone service to the area is down, making it difficult to verify the number of people killed in Monday's violence, which has fueled rising discontent among ethnic Amhara. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
A UNICEF official has told VOA that Ethiopia's drought-stricken population could face a full-blown famine without immediate help. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UNICEF Ethiopia representative Gianfranco Rotigliano told VOA by phone this week his agency is not receiving the necessary foreign aid to avert a humanitarian crisis. He warned eastern Ethiopia could face a famine triggered by years of drought without the additional help. The country is grappling with the most severe drought it has faced since 1981. UNICEF reports 4 years of failed rains have dried up water sources, led to widespread crop failure, and put an estimated 10 million people on life support, nearly half of them children. The agency said severe acute malnutrition has risen sharply in drought-hit areas. In the Somali region alone, it said, there has been a 47% increase. It warned 600,000 children face disease or death without medical and nutritional care. Speaking from Addis Ababa, Rotigliano told VOA he does not have enough money to do what needs to be done.
I'm an old man and I have a been around for many years and I faced many emergencies in my life. But this is the first time in which I have to face a serious and great emergency and I don't have the money I need.
He said only $55 million of UNICEF's $351 million appeal to meet increasing humanitarian needs across Ethiopia this year has been received.
In eastern Ethiopia, I have people that don't have drinking water, literally drinking water. So because I don't have money to pay for the trucks, for the fuel. So I think it could blow into a famine if it is ignored.
The UNICEF official said nearly 1.8 million people have been forced to leave their homes in search of water and grazing land for their cattle.
If you travel with livestock and there is no grass, there is no fodder, there is no water, the bush water is dry, the shallow wells are not there anymore, then the camels die, all the animals die.
Rotigliano called on the outside world to send support, but also called for investments needed to mitigate the impact of climate change. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Third-seeded Anas Jabour of Tunisia today became the first African woman to reach a Grand Slam singles final. The third seed overcame Germany's Tatiana Maria 6-2, 3-6, 6-1 on center court at Wimbledon. Jabour said the victory felt amazing and that she wants to go bigger, inspire many more generations, pointing out that Tunisia is connected to both the Arab world and the African continent. She added, hopefully people are getting inspired. In the deciding set, Jabour twice broke her 34-year-old opponent, who was a first-time Grand Slam semifinalist, en route to the 5-0 lead. The two are friends. 27-year-old Jabour will face 17th-seeded Elena Rybakina in Saturday's final after the 23-year-old Kazakhstan defeated 2019 champion Simona Halep in a dominant display. Since Friday, several Libyan cities have seen angry protests over poor living standards, long power cuts, soaring inflation, and endless lines at gas stations. The anger is largely directed at the destabilizing situation of having two rival governments and two chambers of parliament, which are seen as symbols of the country's division. The Presidential Council has also been signaled out and accused of not doing enough to break the deadlock. Wolfgang Poschtei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi whether the public anger would be enough to pressure the rival parties to reach a compromise.
I don't think that the protesters could be appeased by some kind of compromise between the two rival parliaments and or the two governments. They simply want to get rid of all of them. The protest movement is very inhomogeneous. It ranges from the so-called Baltic Youth Movement, the Yellow Vests, as the relatively largest groups, to local civic youth and youth movements, to supporters of Saifa Islam, and to some radical Islamists. After being initially surprised, several sides, including the Libyan National Army and Prime Minister Dabeiba, are trying to hijack the protests for themselves, stressing that they fully support their demands and stressing that they will now fulfill their desire for elections. However, it is unlikely that this will work. They simply don't have any credibility with the population left. The next weekend will show whether the protest movement is able to continue the demonstrations on a larger scale or not. And depending on how persistent these protests continue, the Dabeiba government could be overthrown and HR and HCS more or less getting dissolved. However, it is currently unclear who might assume power thereafter. The demonstrations are certainly also not pro-Bashar rallies, even if the latter will try to exploit the situation for himself. Some important days are coming up in Libya right now again.
Saif al-Islam Qaddafi called on all Libyan political figures, including himself, to withdraw from the political scene to pave the way for a different group of new Libyan faces to compete in a fair elections that could end the political crisis in Libya. Is that feasible?
Actually, Saif al-Islam proposed two options, as he said, as the last chance for a peaceful resolution of the conflict. The first option, he said, would be to establish a neutral body, which should establish the legal and administrative basis for elections. He said anyone who wants, under this option, might run as a candidate in the election. The decision on these would rest with the people anyway. This option makes certainly some sense if the election could be conducted in an orderly way. The second option, as already mentioned by you, provides for all controversial candidates to withdraw from the presidential elections without any exception, including Said himself. I would say this also would make sense. But does, for example, Prime Minister De Bever consider himself a controversial candidate? In an ideal world, this option could do much to diffuse the tension. But unfortunately, Libya is no ideal world. In a nutshell, I don't believe this will work.
That was Wolfgang Pochtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinnawi. Apprehension has gripped Nigeria's capital after an attack by Islamic militants on a prison freed hundreds of inmates. The drama further undercut confidence in the government's ability to protect its people and left residents wondering what could happen next. We have more details from Abuja.
The brazen attack on the Kuje Medium Custodial Center complex has driven Nigeria's growing sense of insecurity from attacks around the country right into its political heart. Fear of violence and its economic fallout has spread like wildfire across the sprawling capital. The assault, which has been claimed by Islamic State in West Africa, overwhelmed guards Tuesday night as the insurgents came in large numbers, indiscriminately firing automatic weapons. They swarmed the stone and steel complex, setting free 416 inmates, including Boko Haram militants. Killed in the process were four inmates and an official of the Nigeria Defense Corps on duty that night. 16 inmates have been hospitalized. The government says many of the escapees were recaptured, but all those remained free. Security around the prison has been beefed up, but damage is already done. The U.S. government issued a travel warning to its nationals for 19 states, along with a key road between Abuja and the international airport. That has raised concern about the impact on the economy already battered by COVID and the fallout of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
As long as you are a citizen of Nigeria, the insecurity has affected us in different ways, both economic-wise, socially, physically, otherwise, because people now live in fear.
We already know the fact that we have serious insecurity and challenge in the country. I see it as a positive development because it has affected our officials now. They're not directly involved.
Actually, I'm scared. I stay close to Kuje, so I see everybody walking on the road like a criminal. Not as if everybody is, but I had to tighten up my security.
I'm so scared. So now you're leaving, you're scared. Even at 5 o'clock, I have to go out to pick my children from school. I'm scared.
Voices of some Nigerians in the streets of Abuja narrating their fears on the insecurity situation in the country. The publisher of Abuja-based People's Security Monitor, Isiaka Mustafa, expressed fear that if not well handled, Nigeria's insecurity may affect the 2023 election.
I want to believe that in spite of everything, Nigeria will skate through a general election next year. We are not having it for the first time. Only this time around, we are having it in one of the most horrible way and manner. I am very optimistic that a new leader will emerge next year, and that will change the tide of insecurity we're having now.
Security already was a major issue for the presidential election amidst a rush of attacks on churches, transport and other targets, along with mass kidnappings, with the attackers funding the operations with ransoms. People are asking why the government appears hopeless to stem the violence. President Muhammadu Buhari visited the prison yesterday to assess the damage. He queried its intelligence gathering system and why its defenses failed to work. He has requested a comprehensive report on the incident. For VOA News, from Abuja, Nigeria.
Lawmakers from Cameroon's troubled English-speaking regions are calling for more troops to protect officials, government workers, and their families from separatists. Addressing Parliament last night, the legislators said the rebels have abducted hundreds of officials and their family members and killed at least 20 workers in the past month. Moki Edwin-Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon lawmakers say the heavy presence of government troops in the country's troubled English-speaking western regions has not stopped separatist atrocities on civilians. Kavai Yege Jibril is Speaker of Cameroon's National Assembly, called the lower house of parliament. He said Wednesday that several hundred elected officials, government workers and their families are being held captive by separatists in the western regions.
La menace sécuritaire reste jusqu'à la lourde. À cet effet, il me plaît de saluer.
He says insecurity caused by separatist rebels and their brutality is increasing by the day, and lawmakers, village chiefs, and government workers are among the highest victims. Jibril says lawmakers are pleading with civilians to denounce fighters hiding in their villages and towns and report all suspects and their hideout to the military. Jibril says militias should be created in all English-speaking towns and villages to assist government troops to protect civilians and fight separatists. The lawmakers say separatists have killed at least 20 government workers in the last month. Leke Bisongo Akemfo Philip is a lawmaker representing the southwest region in the upper house of parliament. He says a majority of English-speaking lawmakers, mayors, local councillors, and village chiefs and their families have relocated to Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, for safety.
The government should increase security because terrorists kidnap senators, parliamentarians, and other state functionaries and demand ransom. So if the government can get the security operatives to wipe the hideouts, those terrorists will not be able to stay within settlement areas. When this is done, we can go back and know that our security is guaranteed.
Capo Daniel is the Deputy Defense Chief of the Ambazonian Defense Forces, one of Cameroon's separatist groups. He acknowledges that separatists are attacking and abducting Cameroon's government workers and elected officials who represent the central government. He says the attack on government workers and elected officials is part of their campaign to make English-speaking regions ungovernable by the central government in Yaoundé.
Every Cameroon government officials in our territory will be arrested. We will intensify our attacks against the administrative representative. We are fighting to free ourselves from occupation and recolonization.
Capo acknowledged that scores of civilians accused of collaborating with the central government are being held hostage in camps by separatists and did not say if they will be freed. He denied that rebels with separatist groups kidnap people for ransom, but said armed groups in the western regions carry out that practice. The military says it will protect all civilians and their goods, and the central government says elected officials, government workers, and village chiefs who need additional security can apply to the military. A June 2022 Human Rights Watch report accuses Cameroon separatists of brutality in their attacks and says fighters have carried out at least 80 abductions since January. Cameroon's separatist conflict has killed more than 3,300 people and displaced more than 750,000 others since 2017, according to the UN. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
An African think tank focused on energy says Fuel prices are soaring across the continent, not only because of the war in Ukraine, but also because Africa has not taken ownership of the oil it produces. The Benchmarks Foundation says instead of helping each other through the current economic crisis, African governments are selling scarce resources and fuel reserves to Western nations to keep their economies going. This, it says, could soon cause fuel and food shortages and plunge millions of Africans into even greater poverty. Darren Taylor reports.
Benchmark says the fallout from the war must drive African countries and regional blocs to work closer together to get through the crisis instead of acting in self-interest.
The problem with Africa is that, you know, we've decolonized our politics, but we've never decolonized our economies.
Senior Foundation researcher David van Wyk has been studying the impact of the Ukraine conflict on Africa.
Our economies are still dominated by European corporations and Western corporations that actually own almost everything in terms of our extractive industry. And we get very little benefit from that extractive industry. The extractive industry in Africa is not actually living up to the expectations for the development of Africa because we don't own it.
He points out that South Africa, for example, is currently running out of diesel. The shortage is driven by several factors, including the country's electricity crisis. South Africa's coal-driven power stations are failing. To keep some of the lights on, some of the time, the national power utility, Eskom, is burning millions of litres of diesel to feed generators. It's ludicrous, says Van Wyk, that South Africa cannot buy diesel and petrol from its oil-rich neighbours, Angola and Mozambique.
That would require that those countries actually take control of their oil away from the European companies that actually own that oil at the moment, Total and the American company Chevron and Texaco.
South Africa imports fuel mainly from Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. Some energy sector players have suggested that South Africa buy oil from its fellow partner in the BRICS economic bloc, Russia. Besides the questionable morality of this, says Van Wyk, it's simply not feasible right now.
China and India are buying Russian oil on a very large scale, but they get that oil over land, so there can be no interference from this Cold War that has now re-emerged. But if South Africa should try to buy oil from Russia, the problem is that the oil tankers will simply be intercepted by the West on the way here. So that source is not available to South Africa, unfortunately. And South Africa will have to look at the rest of Africa.
But Van Wyk says it's highly unlikely that South Africa will be getting fuel from continental oil producers anytime soon, other than the little it currently imports from Nigeria. He says in an increasingly volatile, unstable world, Africa has to find ways to assert itself and to get the best possible trade deals from both the West and the East.
And that would require that the economic blocs in Africa begin to integrate far more than what they are doing at the moment. At the moment, most of our rail routes, most of our road routes and so on are towards our ports to export whatever raw materials and minerals we have, instead of trading between ourselves to strengthen the African economy rather than allowing our resources just to flow out.
On paper, says Benchmarks, the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, which aims to form the world's largest single market for goods and services, is wonderful. But given the current shape of the global economy and Africa's ongoing isolation, it's just not going to work. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Patrick Deya, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.